Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, formerly known as the Friday Morning Show. So if I ever kind of flub it up and I say the Friday Morning Show, you're going to know why I said that. But of course, I don't think so, because this has been a slot where we have talked about A Course in Miracles for, you know, really off and on for, I'd say, 4 or 5 years. We started with different kinds of renditions of this show, but now it is a talk show, and we do a lot of just discussion about living A Course in Miracles. And in fact, that is the theme that I'm starting out 2019 with on this show, is living A Course in Miracles. And part of that was really inspired because I started listening to Ken Wapnick's workshop that he did, man, I want to say maybe 17 or 18 years ago. So it's been some time ago. I was not lucky enough to actually be in the workshop, but I found it at the online bookstore at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles. And I've been listening to it and enjoying it every single morning. And in fact, I'm so obsessive, I go back and listen to the parts that I really like a lot, because it's just, it's a wonderful piece. I think it's a wonderful workshop. I wish I'd found it before, but then again, you know, timing is everything. I mean, you just find and hear what you need to hear in the moment, and it's always perfect. So I've been listening to that, and I thought, I really want to share some of those excerpts on this show. But it's really that whole theme of, what is it like to live A Course in Miracles, and what does that really mean? How do we get these philosophical, inspirational, spiritual, metaphysical ideas off of that level, and how do we actually apply it in our lives? So that's what we're really going to be focusing on January, February, March. We'll see how long it takes to get through some of these ideas that I have in mind. But if you're listening live today, it's January 18th. And what we're going to do today is, I have somebody on the show, Bruce Rawls. Many of you are familiar with him. He is an avid, what I consider, Course in Miracles student and teacher and small group facilitator and everything else. He's also a web designer and a writer. And in fact, he's helping me do my website, which has been in the making for 10 years. Now, not with Bruce. He's like my third or fourth person. You know, that's a story in itself. I'm sure that's a Course in Miracles forgiveness lesson of why CA will not. I mean, I've had the website. I just won't make it go live. So who knows what that is, and hopefully it's Bruce that will kick me into action this year. I am promising I'm getting it up.
I'll try for Catalyst. How's that?
Okay. Yeah, but it's tough. Like I said, you're at least a third or fourth person in a row, and it's never their fault. I mean, that's the thing. I know it's not their fault. It's just, you know, A Course talks a lot about resistance. Well, I have a lot of resistance to having a website, and I'm not quite sure what that's about, but I'm going to be exploring that, and Bruce is going to be helping me. So he's on the show today, and one of the things I asked him to do is, I said, would you come on the show and just share your personal story of living A Course in Miracles, how you came to the course, what were, you know, some of your early experiences, etc. So we're going to do that today, and hopefully he had also suggested, and he said, oh, CA, that's only going to take 5 or 10 minutes. And I thought, oh, I don't know. Once you start talking about your story, it can get into a lot of details. But he had also said, yeah, and we can talk about inspiration and guidance and strengthening our trust in the Holy Spirit, etc. So as usual, we will just go where we are led to go. And hopefully that will be by the Holy Spirit, not by our egos. But it could be a little of both. I mean, let's face it, right? So before we start with that story, though, I want to, you know, I invite everybody to come into our private group over on Facebook. And we do have that private group running while we are live on 1-2 Radio. So you'll find it during all of the live shows, which is 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, you know, the morning and through the early afternoon. So if you've not ever done that before, you can go to 1-2radio.com. And on the left side of the page, you'll see that chat button. And if you push that, it's a link that'll take you directly to Facebook. And then you can join the other people who are already in the room. And I'd like to greet you. Hey, Greg, thanks. It's always good to see you. And Lynn and Quelly, thank you so much for coming in today. It's always good to see you. And we're here with Bruce, so we're going to have a good day. So, Bruce, you know, I pretty much already introduced you. And so do you just want to launch into your story? Because, you know, sure. I don't think I've heard your story.
Oh, okay. Well, I've shared it so many times, I feel like it's a sort of a broken record. I try to, you know, do that cautiously and reservedly. But since you asked specifically, it's all it's fun to share, but I think it's probably instructive and illustrative of probably the, you know, the form will be different, but the content I think will be the same for everyone. And that's what we'll try to emphasize, something that everyone can relate to. Anyway, first off, thank you for the introduction and for having you on me on your show so many times. I always enjoy these conversations very much. So it's much great appreciation here. So with that out of the way, I was thinking this morning, actually, it's sort of ironic that I'm here where I was actually introduced to the course, in Livermore, California, where I grew up. I'm at my mom's house. She had a brief stint in the hospital this past week, but she's actually doing really well and recovering fairly quickly. So I'm just kind of here more as a precaution kind of a thing to make sure she gets back her energy level and so forth. But anyway, my mom is literally a spiritual mentor from day one, literally and figuratively. And so when I was in my adolescent years, in high school, even I remember a little bit in grade school, just kind of, you know, wondering what is this crazy world all about anyway? You know, the sort of philosophical questions. I think everyone probably entertains them off and on it in some fashion or another, you know, throughout their life, really. I mean, and so I was no exception. Particularly in high school, I think it reached a point where I kind of looked at the branching off places and people going off to college and starting new careers and new lives. And I kind of looked at all that and it's like, huh? it's not that I wasn't going to do that. It was just kind of like, what, you know, why, how, where, you know, what's the big picture here? Yeah. And, so about that same time, I think the early empty nest syndrome was starting to kick in for my mom, even though I have two younger siblings, but she was probably thinking ahead to okay, well, okay, I've raised three kids now, you know, for the most part, now what kind of thing. And so she went on a kind of a metaphysical quest, and dragged the family around a bunch of different conventional Christian churches around the valley that we live in here. and you know, none of them quite did it. And we were all kind of along for the ride. And then when my mom kind of started exploring, everything from Edgar Cayce to channel material to UFO stuff, to, I mean, anything that sounded, you know, like it could have some other explanation of the why we're here question, you know, I was kind of along for that ride. My brother and sister and dad bailed out fairly quickly on that, but it was, you know, for the most part. But I kind of, you know, was entertaining the same kind of questions. And so, you know, we basically had, you know, had this lifelong quest for, you know, what's it all about.
And when you were a kid, did you guys go to church? Did you belong to any particular
church? Yeah, like there was a Presbyterian church that we probably went to for the longest time. That was, you know, about a mile north of here. And you know, do that every Sunday. And then after a while, it was just like, and uh-huh. That kind of thing, you know. And I think you know, for me it was just, you know, kind of the era when you start to question things more, you know, typical adolescent, you know, why am I doing this kind of thing. But for my mom it was more of a, you know, an inner quest. Oh, you know, I should preface this with one of the things I think that triggered that experience for her, and maybe I haven't shared this before, but when my mom was a teenager, her grandmother on my maternal side, had a beach house on Catalina Island off the coast of California. And my mom and her sister would spend a lot of their summers there and fond memories. One particular summer when she was in her adolescence, there was a whole beach full of people that looked up and saw a fleet of things moving really fast across the sky. And then they made this abrupt right angle turn and disappeared. And my mom said if it was a hallucination, it was a mass hallucination, because she said from her peripheral vision, all the heads were turning at once. And they all kind of looked at each other and said, what was that? So I think that's what led to her interest in UFOs in particular, which continues unabated to this day, and all things paranormal, mystical, and I guess generally alternative, you could say. But, you know, that gave us an intro to a lot of metaphysical ideas and thinking that wouldn't otherwise had. So I think I've cleared most of the books out of this particular bedroom, but my mom has three guest bedrooms in the house here, and two of them are like almost floor to ceiling with books, of which probably 60-70% are of the metaphysical variety. So I kind of, you know, got it up through osmosis, if nothing else. And among the many books that were in that metaphysical library were the three blue books at the time that constituted A Course in Miracles. So I knew about them from the late 70s. They were here in the house. I think I might have flipped them open once or twice, and it looked kind of like Christian terminology, and so, you know, I set them aside. And finally, when I moved to Grass Valley, Nevada City area, California, Northern California foothills, and built a geodesic dome and did a bunch of different things, but it wasn't until I moved to the Grass Valley area in 84 that I finally cracked open those books. I kind of grabbed them from Mom's library with the usual, you know, ongoing library, lending library, family, metaphysical lending library kind of system. And my mom's a major networker and still continues to have metaphysical group meetings here, weekly basis kind of thing. Anyway, the upshot of that was that, I'm trying to ramble on and extend this 5-minute story into something more like 10.
Well, but you know, this is what I want to hear. I mean, fact, like already I'm questioning, like, okay, so when you grabbed those books off her bookshelf, was it because you said, oh, I've heard these people talk about A Course in Miracles and I want to do this? Or I haven't tried these books yet. What are these books about?
It was a little bit of both. I think mostly about that era, I was involved in a program called Creative Dynamics. And it was basically positive thinking, you know, looking at the mind, looking at your behavior and habits. But it was really, you know, a lot of the emphasis was about the mind, and that really appealed to me because I thought, wow, that's something, you know, you can do something about. Whereas the external circumstances, well, maybe not so much in a lot of cases. So, you know, that had a lot of appeal to me. And there was a fellow by the name of Floyd Edwards and his wife Jackie, and they had this program where they were teaching classes in, you know, positive thinking and leadership and human relations and in the California prison system. And they flew up and down the state every week and drove all over, you know, teaching classes up and down the state. And so I got involved in that, and I got a special teaching credential. And with my first wife, who I just discovered passed on a few years ago, which I didn't know. We'd parted company, you know, amicably, several decades ago now. And I think the people that she was with didn't know my last name, so I actually just Googled her found her in the obituaries.
Oh my gosh!
A couple of weeks ago, and it was like, whoa, that's bizarre. But anyway, it's a little story in itself, is that, you know, we were both teaching these metaphysical ideas before we really knew much about A Course in Miracles. We just kind of knew of it from Marianne Williamson and Jerry Jampolsky. But we were involved in this program, and we met weekly, and we were through Nevada County school system, through the adult ed program there. We're teaching three classes a week in what was called Creative Dynamics. And so I had, you know, a special ed teaching credential for that. And I was just really, you know, barely out of college at that point. In fact, I interspersed interleaved my college years with that to a certain extent, because I actually went back to college and finished my engineering degree. But what I was really interested in at UC Davis, where I went to school and studied electrical engineering, more than the engineering, because, you know, that was sort of encouraged by my dad, which kind of made sense on a practical level. But the technical is interesting, but even more interesting to me was the psychology. So one of the instructors that I've discovered was a course student years later was a fellow who some people may know of named Charles Tart. Or Charlie Tart, as he's often known. And he taught several classes that I attended, one of which was his sort of basic upper graduate psychology course. And I was an undergraduate, lower division engineering major. So, but I got to take some of these courses anyway, and it was called Altered States of Consciousness. And that in that particular class, we learned that he'd covered a lot of ground and just really interesting stuff. It was very scholarly, but at the same time, it was fascinating. And he presented it in a way that was like, wow, there's, you know, the mind is an amazing thing. And, you know, there's so many aspects of it that we just, you're barely scratching the surface of. And that was kind of my impression. And then I went on to take other classes in humanistic psychology and then a graduate seminar, even though I wasn't a psychology major or a graduate, in Gurdjieff, and Uspensky and, you know, some of that kind of material. And that was also fascinating. And when, again, it was always about looking at the mind and being mindful and watching the contents of the mind. And we read these wonderful little Sufi stories, and Idris Shah books and things like that. But getting back to the progression though, is it was basically, again, the Oprah show with Marianne Williamson and then Jerry Jampolsky and learning about what the work they were doing, which kind of aligned with what we were doing in the adult school system. And then finally, when I moved to, moved from the Bay Area here to up to the foothills in Auburn, California, is when I finally decided, maybe I could in Grass Valley area, but maybe I could open these blue books that they keep talking about on these shows and see what's in them. And like they say, the rest is history. I did actually was involved in study groups and a lot of different activities related to A Course in Miracles. I even went to a conference in South Lake Tahoe up at Echo Lake and met Lee Coit, who was part of the Awaken to Love conference that happened a couple of months ago, an international online conference, and who I hadn't run across for years. And there was, several other people that I keep running into now and then. But I studied the course fairly intently for a few years. And then I, for the most part, set it aside. I'd pick it up occasionally. But the first year or so that I studied it, it was really a pivotal year for me. And I think what propelled me deeper into the course, not so much on an intellectual level, but on a visceral, emotional trust. It was kind of like a little bit of a dark night of the soul kind of a time period for me, because my father, grandfather, and uncle all passed away the same year. And another friend who was in one of these course study groups in Grass Valley also passed. And so that was like a big wake-up call. Then I went through it. The same year I went through a divorce, changed where I work, changed where I live. You know, if you kind of look at those stress factor things, if you buy into that stuff. It was one of those off-the-chart years. And so I really spent a lot of time just finding tremendous solace and comfort in the mellows, as Ken Wofnick would say, of the course. I mean, I didn't have that word at the time, but now in retrospect, that was what I was allowing to wash through me and inspire me to continue with it. And, but then again, like I say, but then my resistance, I think kicked in for a number of years until, 2007. I was doing a combination of volunteering and consulting for the Rogue Valley Metaphysical Library in Ashland, Oregon, when I'd moved up there.
What kind of consulting were you doing for them?
Basically, web and graphics and email, like MailChimp stuff.
Okay. Technical support.
Yeah, I was helping them rewire an audio-video console where they recorded the weekly metaphysical events that they hosted there in the library and just stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun and met a lot of great people. Including a bunch of people that I got to see this past weekend on my way down from where I now live in Oregon, in Ashland and Phoenix, and study groups that I attended there for about 7 years. So that was kind of fun. Folks like I didn't see this particular person, but I was in the metaphysical library where I was looking at Gary Renard's first book. And just happened to be standing next to me, it was another fellow named Mike Lemieux, who some people may know as Giddy Up Mikey, and he came to the study groups that we put together, and were already there quite a number of times for several years, and he was starting to accumulate a bunch of quotes from Gary Renard's book that were his favorite quotes, and I said, well, maybe you could write a book too, Mike, and that's how the Jesus Fish book came about. Not that it wasn't his effort, of course, but again, I felt like I was sort of maybe a catalyst for that. So in some way, So that was kind of fun, and he had a lot of fun with that. And anyway, so and still a lot of friends in the southern Oregon area, in the Rogue Valley particularly. So anyway, but I think that kind of, for the most part, brings you up to date. It was really that pivotal moment in 84 when I picked up the course, and then again what propelled me from kind of a slump past a plateau of a certain sort for many years, where I'd only occasionally pick it up, was 2007 when I picked up Gary's first book, Disciplines of the Universe, Gary Renard's, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to reread the course. I mean, because it was like, God didn't make the universe. You know, how did I miss that? And then it's all about forgiveness. How did I miss that? Those were kind of the two, you know, big aha moments in reading DU that, or Disciplines of the Universe that did it for me. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And then of course that immediately plunged me into the wonderful, depth, breadth, and profundity of Ken Wapnick's work. So.
Yeah. Anyway, well, so, but there again, how did you come across Ken Wapnick? Was it through Gary's work and his book?
You know, I think that would have been one of many reminders, because I think, you know, Gary mentions Ken in, I think, probably each of his books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like he definitely talks about the foundation when it was in New York.
Right. Right.
Upper yep. State New York. I can't remember the name of the city, but yeah.
Right.
I think he does mention that. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah.
So that's kind of an extended version of some of the highlights of my involvement with the course. And in the last few years, actually really pretty much since 2007, that's been my, you know, full-time metaphysical spiritual practice discipline, and I'm finding it easier and easier and easier to look at the resistance with compassion and just say, oh, well, there that is, and drop it more quickly. And I think, you know, as you were suggesting earlier, just listening to and watching the work of Ken Wapnick and sort of as an appetizer / dessert, Gary Renard's work, I find is really helpful too. In fact, this last year, Lynn Johnson, who's a fellow course student and facilitates a whole lot of things with the ACIM Gather program. We share an hour on Saturday mornings, and we spent literally a year going through Gary's fourth book, reading that aloud together and talking about it. So, and now we're reading The Journey Home, thanks to you, on Saturday morning. So anyway, yeah, because you were the one who kept nudging me and said, yeah, I've got to check this out. And boy, I've read it once, and now we're reading it aloud together, and it's wonderful.
It's an incredible book, isn't it?
It really is. It really is, yeah. So hopefully that personal detail gave some context. And again, I think the important thing is not the specifics, but really that inner longing to find, you know, what's true. And I oftentimes, I'll share this when another interest of mine, which has sort of grown arithmetically while the Course in Miracles interest has grown exponentially and geometrically, if that makes any sense to anyone. Uh-huh. Is sacred geometry. I've started with a geometric metaphor. And so I oftentimes tell people that, you know, that interest hasn't subsided. It's just become, you know, sort of like it's superseded in a way by wanting to know the why. And I think so my initial interest in what's now become known as sacred geometry back in my high school days, and then I went on a trip to Egypt with a fellow named Greg Braden, which some people may know of, who does a lot of metaphysical work, but it's a lot of his work is about looking at the mind too. And so there were 21 of us that went in 1992 to Egypt, one of whom is now my wife, Nancy, and we actually got married there in a little ceremony on the island of Philae at the Hathor Temple, which was kind of fun. And I'm rattling and rambling a bit, but I think what I was trying to get back to was the idea that what got me interested in the sacred geometry and then reignited that with Greg Braden's work which he was inspired by a fellow named Drumvalo Melchizedek, and you know, some fascinating stuff there. And again, it's all about, you know, what is it for, and how do we apply this? And the question that seemed like the deeper question that ran through all of this inquiry, as I went through spiritual metaphysical buffet line, so to speak, and smorgasbord over the years, particularly in those interim years between first picking up the course for a few years and then 2007 when Gary's book, it was that can opener experience, as so many people describe, was really why and what can I take with me that is consistent? What is true regardless of the circumstance? And that's kind of what I think what fascinated with me that with the geometric metaphors, because you know the laws of geometry and physics and math, you know, they don't you know pay extra for certain people, you know, and
yeah,
know, there's no tax that's different for you know. you don't have to pay a tax to use the laws of geometry, and that they don't apply unequally to certain people, you know, or if you go to a different galaxy or a different planet, you probably are going to get the same, you know, quadratic formula and the same sum of the angles of a triangle is 180 degrees. And in, you know, the, I'm assuming the,
I don't know about that, Bruce.
Well, of course, now, that's where, yeah, exactly. That we're speaking to the Newtonian model and not the Einsteinian model and the other geometries. It's been a while since I've dabbled much in that, but, you know, the curved space stuff, but, anyway, it's fascinating too. But to me, I always want to know what doesn't change. That was kind of the bottom line. What doesn't change? What is really worthy of my trust? Because anything that changes ultimately isn't. And that was kind of like my guiding principle. And that's why when I read Gary's first book and it was all about the pure non-duality, it's like everything about that just made so much sense.
Right.
That how could anything that shifts and morphs and alters. interesting. I would land on that word. I one of my friends that I got to reconnect with in Ashland, Oregon, is I'm not sure if you call him a Shakespearean scholar, but he's involved in the Oregon Shakespeare Festival there, and at some of the study groups in Ashland, he used to recite the Sonnet 116 from Shakespeare. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but basically I won't butcher it, but it basically it's about, you know, trusting what doesn't change. I'll stop right there because otherwise I won't do it justice at all. But if you look up Sonnet 116, it's very lovely and poetic, and it's talking about what's really love couldn't possibly change. So the world's definition of love is pretty much out at the get-go.
Right.
So anyway.
Hey, and by the way, I wanted to ask you, are you in the chat room this morning over on Facebook?
I haven't been yet.
Okay, well, the reason I wondered is because while you were talking, Greg said, please ask him about Greg Braden and sacred geometry.
Oh, okay.
I thought, okay, I'll do that, but, you know, not until he's kind of, you know, through where he's going. And then all of a sudden you start talking about it, and I thought, oh, maybe he's in the chat room, either that or maybe you're just psychic, or maybe Greg is psychic and said, I know he knows about that, so please ask him.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I have another website in addition to acimblog.com. It's called geometrycode.com. Both of them need attention, but there's still plenty of content there if people are interested, and I have a lot of fun with both. And both have newsletters that people can subscribe to, and whenever I make updates, they get those bulletins. And so anyway, yeah, there's lots of amazing stuff there. But again, the thing that always fascinated me is what's universal? What doesn't change? What's the fixed and constant star, the Shakespeare sonnet? Oh, okay, I'll give a little bit of it. It's talking about, yeah, you know, how does a boat navigate? You know, that's the mundane translation. You have to have a fixed star to guide it by, you know, the North Star, so to speak. I think Shakespeare does a great job comparing, you know, true love to that fixed star, and rather than a, something that's going to take you off course. And so I think A Course in Miracles is beautifully, founded by the idea that it's a pure non-dual awareness that we believe we've left but never have. So to kind of tie that into sacred geometry, I think we can, again, use any symbol as a mechanism for looking at duality or non-duality. So the second book that I wrote, the first one in about sacred geometry, if you go to the geometrycode.com website, is called Sacred Geometry Design Sourcebook. And in that one, I just had a field day with, I think there's over 1,300 variations of different patterns in this spiral bound book. And I had a lot of fun putting it together. Just a lot of fun, kind of, again, sort of universal archetypal geometric patterns that seem to occur over and over again that have the principle of interconnectedness. And the golden ratio, which, I mean, we could spend the whole rest of the half hour and several other sessions, which I've done many times, talking about things like the golden ratio and the Vesica Pisces and geometric shapes that contain metaphorically or metaphysically the principle of interconnectedness and interrelatedness. And that, I think, is epitomized with the golden ratio, which, you know, the kind of classic example is a five-pointed star that if you take any segment that makes up that five-pointed star, the ratio of the elements are divided by this, you know, framed, if you will, or divided by or proportional by the golden ratio. And it goes infinitely far in both directions. You can keep extending a star and drawing a pentagon around the pentagram, which is another name for five-pointed star, and then extending the arm, so to speak, of the sides of that pentagon to make another five-pointed star. And each time you do that, it becomes a power of the golden ratio with the difference that you've just added. So and then those are, you know, evident in everything in nature, from five, from the sea stars, also known as starfish. Since I've learned at the coast, I've been corrected that it's the sea star. Yeah. You'll say starfish on the coast, yeah. But
and it's a sea star.
A sea star, yeah.
Okay.
And then every edible fruit has a flower that's is five-sided geometry. So, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, fascinating stuff around that. I mean, there's a ton of stuff on the Geometry Code website. And every time I run across something interesting, I make a little post about it there. So anyway, the first book was all about the geometric patterns that embody these really amazing, I think, truly mystical relationships. But again, what's the purpose of that shape if it's not to remind you to get back to the mind and look at the principle of interconnectedness in everything you do and see and say and experience. So that was really the premise that led me to the second book. Along the lines of my metaphysical studies, when I had moved to the foothills, Northern California, and was teaching those aforementioned adult school classes, the teacher that I had at the time, named Floyd Edwards, introduced me to, and a lot of people in the same group, to a little book called The Kybalion. And it's not the Kabbalah, but the Kybalion. And it was, I think, first published in 1912. And so the book that I published that was sort of like a new look at it, it was literally a century later in 2012 when it came out, it was called The Geometry Code. And it was initially going to be about sacred geometry and the Hermetic laws, of which there are seven, in this wonderful little book called The Kybalion. The first of which will probably be very familiar and comfortable to any student of A Course in Miracles is called the Law of Mentalism, and that everything is mental, all exists in mind. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
as physicist John Wheeler said, there's no out there.
Right.
And then there's six other what they call universal or hermetic laws that apply to everything. The next being the law of correspondence, and that's the classic. It's sometimes referred to as a Rosicrucian axiom, but I think the Rosicrucians got it from the Hermetics, from what I understand. Quite a few centuries or millennia before that. Not that that's any big deal, but the as above, so below principle, or as within, so without, is the law of correspondence, which basically I think used properly. Again, all of these laws and all of these, you know, geometries and all of these metaphors used with guidance of what we, of course, miracles would call the Holy Spirit, or I sometimes say our inner kindness teacher. Some people will say that, you know, the Jesus of the Course, give a whole different, a completely different meaning to things. So, for example, mentalism applied with coarse understanding would say there's two thought systems. And we are always choosing between those two thought systems, but it's all about mind. The law of correspondence would be able to, put into coarse terms would say we're either always projecting or always extending. Everything corresponds to a place in the mind. And because there's no out there, ideas don't leave their source. The law of correspondence is just a way to get back to the mind. So it's basically a tool. So all of these hermetic laws, as they're called, really are about dealing with illusion seen properly and then getting back to the mind. Then there's the law of vibration, the third of the hermetic laws. Everything vibrates. There's always a frequency or a spectrum of frequencies to everything in the world. But then again, what are we using those vibrations for? What are we tuning into, so to speak? What thought system are we resonating with? The next one is the law of polarity. Not a strange concept for people who study the Course for a while. The ego's realm is solidly in the realm of polarity and duality and division. And, right at the beginning, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. Right at that very outset, we get a corollary to the ego's use of the law of polarity, which is that perfect oneness has no opposite, and that's what we really are. So that, I think, becomes a mechanism by which we can look at how we tend to polarize. Certainly looking at, let's just pick an example, the political climate in the United States in the last couple of years. But it could go back as far as you like. Extend to anywhere and any when. Because, the ego strategy is to divide and conquer, but the only thing it's really conquering is itself. So looking at the law of polarity through the ego's eyes, it just becomes a vicious cycle. But looking at the law of polarity through the Holy Spirit's eyes, it's like, okay, how can I use, and Jesus does this brilliantly in his course, almost every paragraph or certainly in every section, he does essentially a gentle yet scathing expose of the ego and presents it, if you're seeing it with the right perspective, as a hilarious, outrageously funny, laughable idea that we've somehow taken seriously. And then he contrasts that with the profound peace that results from letting go of that. So the polarity or the contrast, the difference between the two thought systems is made remarkably evident. And so we can use the law of polarity, the fourth hermetic law, in a kind way rather than a destructive way. Again, as we can use all these other hermetic laws. And then the fifth one would be the law of rhythm, which is basically recognition of the habits that we form and how time and time again with practice, we can transform just about anything. I mean, you can – one of the classic examples is if you're in a sailboat and the wind is blowing from where you want to go, that's not necessarily an obstacle. I haven't done much sailing, but one time I was on a lake in Northern California and in a little sailboat, and then the people who knew, more about it than I, basically, well, it's not a problem. You just tack against the wind. You go back and forth, and you get actually to where the wind is blowing by not approaching it directly, but approaching it indirectly.
Right.
And that's the way the course works too, is we don't really go directly to, the piece of perfect oneness. We look at the obstacles we've placed and we kind of tack back and forth, and there's sort of a rhythm to it. And we look at the seasons and the cyclical nature of, our resistance and the archetypal patterns as we go around the year. I'm sure you could speak volumes on that astrologically, and all those kind of patterns, but we can use each of those influences as an opportunity to look at the mind and choose a thought system, of which there are only two, that leads to healing and integration. And then the last two laws of the seven hermetic laws are cause and effect. Again, not a strange idea to a Course in Miracles students. In fact, early in the text, Jesus says, if I were to deprive you, I'm going to paraphrase as usual, if I were to deprive you of your free will, I would be tampering with the base, most fundamental law there is, the law of cause and effect. So that's the sixth of the hermetic laws. I mean, not that any one of these laws is more important than any other, or prioritize whatever. But, you know, that one just basically says every cause has an effect and every effect has a cause. And, you know, again, putting that into course terms, the ego's cause, which is insane, leads to an insane effect, which is essentially the double shield of oblivion, I think is a great way to look at it, is the cause of the belief in separation led to an insane thought system of sin, guilt, and fear. And then to try to escape from that, to attempt to be a fugitive from that, we made up a whole universe. I mean, how outrageous is that? In order to try to escape from an imaginary enemy that the ego's God, a little lowercase g, that doesn't exist. And, you know, what a crazy idea. But that's a perfect example of cause and effect applied to projection. But our instructor in this beloved curriculum is saying, hey, there's another way of looking at this. You know, listen to this guidance. And it, instead of making a prison for yourself, you can make a very enjoyable classroom. Doesn't mean that the form is going to be, you know, magical and fulfill every ego bucket list checklist thing on out there, but it can check off all the spiritual growth check marks by forgiving, and recognizing and generalizing that they're all the same. And that leads to the seventh of the Hermetic laws, which is the law of gender or generation, or I like to say generalization. And that is when we put thought and feeling, or it's essentially the masculine and feminine aspects of creation together, recognizing that, you know, it takes our whole being to make it work. And we have to integrate everything and everyone, and to generalize, we have to look at the ways that we've consciously or unconsciously excluded people from our definition of self. And it's really that integration that helps us to generalize and to see that no matter what's happening, the same laws apply. So I think these seven Hermetic laws are kind of cool because they really, seen properly, again, without that coarse perspective of the pure non-dual metaphysics, you know, they'd just be another, you know, kind of interesting metaphysical system put on a shelf, but you know, activated and enlivened with coarse understanding, they become a powerful tool, just like anything else can be given the right thought system. So that's what I tried to put in this second book called The Geometry Code. And I had a lot of fun doing it. And as you will notice, if you read it, it started out to be about the Hermetic laws and some seven geometric symbols that I thought went along very nicely with those Hermetic laws that encapsulated the metaphysical principles of each of those laws. But it quickly evolved once I oh, here's another backstory. Since you asked for the story, I'll make this brief. And hey, I have almost filled the whole hour, haven't I?
Yes, you have. And it's been fascinating. In fact, you know, I mean, I love – you know, there are so many interesting things in the world. And as you, I mean, I think the underlying concept that you keep coming back to is every single thing we experience and know can lead us to a greater truth.
Absolutely.
Every single thing can be our vehicle, yes, regardless of what it is.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Oh, so anyway, in 2007, literally the same weekend that I, and what really propelled me to go to the metaphysical library and look for Gary Renard's books was the fact that in 2007, a friend of my wife, actually had worked with this lady, and she needed a house sitter because she was going to Hawaii for a week and a half. We were living in Eagle Point, which is north of Medford, and most of my web consulting and client work was in Ashland, which is on the other side of Medford. And so when our friend Claire said, hey, can anybody house sit? I said, well, sure, I'll do that. And I thought, well, I'm going to start working on my second book. Well, again, my second book was going to be primarily about sacred geometry, you know, plenty of metaphysics, but you know, more about the patterns and the geometry and so forth. Well, the Geometry Code book, ironically, became almost, you know, the geometry was just a minor backdrop. And I tried to put that in the info. Because what happened was on Claire's coffee table were Gary's first two books.
Oh.
And what really anchored it for me that, like, oh, maybe I could, you know, crack these open was I thought, well, let's just for a little entertainment, let's go see this documentary called Living Luminaries. And in this documentary was Don Miguel Ruiz, who I'd interviewed on community radio in Northern California when I was a sub DJ there for a station called KVMR, which is a great little radio station. And Marianne Williamson, and let's see who was, I think Neil Donald Walsh, Eckhart Tolle, a lot of names people are familiar with. But then there was this person I hadn't heard of named Gary Renard. And I was particularly taken with what he was sharing. And then I get home after going to this home being this temporary home, house sitting, and there on the coffee table were Gary's two books. And it's like, okay, I think you're trying to tap me on the shoulder here. And I cracked open DU. And I thought, well, this week and a half that I was going to spend writing my second book and doing more work on that became totally immersed in reading Gary's book, and that's what I did that week and a half. And instead, but it was great because it actually turned turned around the whole nature of what that book was going to be about. It started out being more about geometry, and it ended up being more about A Course, Miracles, and Metaphysics. So it's kind of a transitional book in a way. It's basically sort of a bridge across those two interests. So I had a lot of fun with that. So,
nice.
Anyway,
Well, and since you've mentioned the disappearance of the universe several times, I want to, for anybody who may not be familiar with it, it was written by Gary Renard, and it's basically his experience, his introduction to A Course in Miracles. But it's one of these really pivotal books that speaks to many, many, many people. And even I, many times, if I'm talking to somebody about A Course, I tell them not necessarily, oh, go buy the books. I say, read this book first and see what you think. It's not absolutely necessary, but I do think A Course in Miracles is a fairly heavy, it's a very comprehensive spiritual system. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, for those of us who have grown up in mostly Christian religions, and the reason I'm saying unfortunate is we hear the words, which in A Course in Miracles, it literally is rewriting, reinterpreting many Christian concepts. Mm-hmm. So if you open it up, and you just start seeing these words, forgiveness, salvation, we automatically jump to the idea that we know what they mean.
Right.
And of course we do, because we're steeped, why wouldn't we?
We know the conventional Christian meaning of it, but the non-dual metaphysical meaning of it is in almost every case completely opposite. Because and it's not just to pick on Christianity, but the conventional formal religions are really about behavior and reinforcing guilt. And of course, miracles is all about undoing the guilt. And behavior is irrelevant, ultimately. I mean, it doesn't mean that we should misbehave, but it just means we need to look at the causal factor.
The cause, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And really work with that.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, that was pretty much the thought anyway.
Well, and in fact, I was going to, and that, really, I hope I'm not like just picking on you or something, but when you made the comment about, I'm trying to even think of exactly how you said it, that you'd find the same things on other planets. The only reason I was responding to that is I remember getting into a conversation one time with somebody who kept insisting there couldn't be aliens and there couldn't be life on any other planets because they don't have the chemical atmospheric conditions of Earth. And I said, well, then you're assuming that all life is human, or that all life has to breathe oxygen, right, or that all life needs water. And they just kind of looked at me like, well, it does. And I said, why? How do you know that there aren't alternative forms of life that don't require that at all? I mean, look at animals and insects and plants. So to say there's not life on other planets is to say life as you define it on planet Earth. But I'll tell you, that person just kind of like, I'm not talking to you anymore. But
I'm reminded. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but those are the kinds of experiences I have in my life, actually a lot. Not so much that I'm telling somebody that, but just how often I'm struck by, in a course, like when it says you have to challenge every belief that you have. You don't have to throw it out. You just have to challenge it. Exactly. And how often I'm kind of faced with going, oh my God, you made this major assumption and you weren't even aware you were doing it.
Exactly. Just look at the investment. Look at when it's a big deal rather than a preference that can be, gone past, and not a big deal kind of thing. When you talk about life on other planets, I was kind of reminded of Eric Idle's Galaxy song from the Monty Pythons, and the concluding lyric is something to the effect of, you know, hopefully we'll find intelligent life out there because there doesn't seem to be much here, you know, and which kind of reminded me of Gandhi's comment. Once he was asked about Western civilization, what he thought of it, and his response was he thought it'd be a good idea.
Yeah, right.
Anyways, but yeah, I think again it's important to not take it so seriously, and I think that's what so much formal religion is about, is really making the dream real, and that plays right into the ego's handbag. Not to condemn any particular religion or anything that helps people get to a place of looking at their mind, because I think we can come, you know, from that place. But I think we have to go beyond the form. We have to go beyond the specifics and really generalize. And I think that's why the last of the seven hermetic laws is generalization. And I think the last part of both the text and the workbook, and probably the manual too, I suppose, is
about relative generalization.
Generalization is a beginning, not an end, and we need to keep applying it until we go from a little willingness to abundant willingness, and to where eventually the instantaneous response is to forgive rather than to condemn, and that takes a lot of practice. So.
Yeah. The rest of our lives kind of practice.
but it pays off though. I mean, because if you look at your life and recognize how much more peaceful you are than when you first got into the course, I mean, it's night and day. I mean, there's plenty more to do, and there's still days when you look at your mind and say, oh my gosh, there's all that crap running there. I think having a more forgiving attitude toward that is hugely helpful. You know, a tranquil mind is not a little gift, as the Course says.
Yes. Well, and Bruce, I just want to thank you so much. I mean, I really do appreciate your coming on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And, you know, and just exploring your experience and expressing it. And of course, I know we could talk another hour, but our producer, Brittany's not going to let us talk another hour because, of course, she has other people to get on the air, including KDB with Multidimensional Living. So you've got 1 minute to wrap up. So what would you like to say in 1 minute?
I'd like to hear your story at some point. Maybe if you haven't already done that.
We'll do it on another show. Okay. We will do that.
That'd be fun, yeah. And I guess I'd just like to share for people that may not have checked out, I think the two most important websites for students of A Course in Miracles are acim.org, which is the Foundation for Inner Peace, and that's just been completely redone, launched a couple months ago, and in fact almost exactly 2 months ago. It's got a frequently asked questions page that has a lot of great information. If you want to read and study today's workbook lesson, you can tap the ticker tape text to take today's tutorial. How's that for alliteration? And lots of great stuff that it was moved over from the archive site. And then, of course, the facim.org, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles website, which has the huge, wonderful, profound and prolific teachings of Ken Wapnick. The folks at Foundation for Inner Peace are also moving more into the video realm and filling that the gap as well. And then Jeff Sieberling is also teaching classes in the Henderson, Nevada area, initially on site, but I think that's probably going to go back online too. So I encourage people to check out acim.org and facim.org.
I've posted both of those in the chat room, and I will also post Bruce's website as well, which is the ACIM blog. So, everybody, thank you so much for being here today. Brittany, thanks for being our producer.
Thanks.
Please come find me on 1-2-Listen, and just thank you so much for being here. We're going to have fun this year as we talk about living A Course in Miracles. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.